Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, your one-stop shop for all the latest in science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, a veritable S-storm in the Twitter sphere involving a spoof account and the German Chancellor.
I don't have a problem with Twitter in the sense that they believe in sort of freedom of expression, and there's a lot of parody accounts on Twitter. But there is a line where, you know, people can impersonate other people.
Or not, as the case may be. Also on the programme, researchers in London say they've found a link between psychopathy and abnormalities in the brain. And we'll be hearing from Next Berlin. All that and more right here on Spectrum. But first, there's been a bit of a storm online this week following the worldwide shutdown and then reopening of a popular Twitter account called Angela Dear Merkel. After our dear leader, the German Chancellor, of course. Well, the account had over 26,000 followers. It was well known for dry one-liners about European affairs and had a hint of coming straight from Berlin, the capital. André Leslie reports on the satirical Twitter account that was shut down, then reopened and then moved.
So pleased to have solved the Euro crisis. Looking forward to solving it again next week. It's surprising how long you have to hold Nicolas Sarkozy's face in a bowl of soup before he agrees with you. Frustrating day. Wolfgang Schäuble keeps beating me at Sudoku. I think he's been practicing.
Does that sound to you like German Chancellor Angela Merkel speaking English? Well, somebody apparently thought so, because otherwise the Twitter account Angela D. Merkel would probably never have hit the headlines. After a number of emails from us at DW, the imitator himself agreed to speak with me from a hidden number. He also wanted to remain unnamed.
I mean, who I am is not of great interest, but I'm happy to talk about my background, which is essentially I'm someone who grew up in Brussels in Euroland as part of the European generation, and I suppose I have a cynical view of current developments.
After starting up in November of last year, the impersonator himself admits that he was surprised it took so long for the parody account to get shut down.
It was reported for what I think Twitter describe as malicious impersonation. Now, I don't have a problem with Twitter in the sense that they believe in sort of freedom of expression, and there's a lot of parody accounts on Twitter. But there is a line where, you know, people can impersonate other people.
Twitter expert Mark Dang An from the School of Media Science at the University of Bonn confirms that unless the comments on an account are defamatory, only the person being impersonated can get a fake account shut down by Twitter.
People aren't allowed to impersonate when it is not recognizable as a satirical account. But Twitter even gives suggestions on how to make this clear, by getting people to write fake, not, or fan on the account, for instance. Or, and this is particularly interesting in this case, since the account was in English, a fake account can be shown by being written in the wrong language.
Merkel herself has chosen not to have an official Twitter account, but she does have a press officer who likes to tweet a lot. So we sent him a message on Twitter asking whether the Chancellor's office had forced the closure of the Angela D. Merkel account. No response. An email and a phone call to the Chancellor's office went unanswered. Twitter itself also refused to comment for privacy reasons. Shortly after these requests, however, the Angela D. Merkel account was reactivated. Then it was closed off completely, and the parody imitator was forced to change his Twitter account address to @QueenEurope. The idea of imitators setting up fake websites is nothing new. Most public figures have a number of imitator sites. How they react to the fake accounts varies, however. Ex-French President Nicolas Sarkozy is believed to have had a number of impersonators shut down on Twitter earlier this year, before the elections.
Die Veränderungen, die wir in den letzten Jahren durch das Internet erfahren haben, lassen sich historisch sicherlich.
That's the new video series on YouTube with the German Chancellor. With most politicians out there trying to improve their online presence, Mark Dang An says it's hard to say whether the impersonators or the politicians are winning the battle for attention.
Regierungssprecher ist ein
The German government spokesman uses his Twitter account very well. That doesn't mean he is particularly cool, but he knows how to use the technology. The fake accounts differ. There are some good ones. There is another Angela Merkel imitator site which isn't as good, for instance. It's just not very funny.
Der ist aber nicht so gut. Das ist einfach nicht lustig.
At least in the case of one man in Brussels, the potential for further parody tweeting about the EU is high, it seems.
I've always been fascinated by Chancellor Merkel for obvious reasons. She's a bit of an enigma. She's an incredible political force. But, you know, when you look at the characters coming out of Brussels, like, Herman Van Rompuy, Catherine Ashton, President Barroso, you know, to mention but a few, I think there's lots of material there. So I'd say watch this space. There's room for plenty more parodies on Twitter.
This looks like a battle that is going to go on for a good time yet, unless Twitter gets more active in shutting down fake accounts, something which it seems unlikely to do. Andre Leslie for DW.
Scientists at King's College London's Institute of Psychiatry say they have the strongest evidence yet that psychopathy is linked to specific abnormalities in the brain. The researchers used magnetic resonance imaging to scan the brains of 44 violent adult male offenders who'd been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. Their crimes included murder, rape, grievous bodily harm, or GBH as it's otherwise known. A third of them met the criteria for psychopathy, which means that they present a lack of empathy and remorse and use aggression to secure what they want. Well, the study is the first of its kind and could have implications for how violent offenders are treated medically and by the law. I spoke to the lead author, Dr. Nigel Blackwood.
There's been about a decade of brain imaging research looking at psychopathic men, but this is the first study to contrast the two groups, psychopathic men and non-psychopathic antisocial men, very carefully matched for things like substance misuse histories, life course history, etc. So there are clear brain deficits in the psychopathic group compared to antisocial men without psychopathy and another matched normal group of men. So there are clear deficits, that's them in their early 30s. Other work in our laboratory has shown that the callous unemotional children also have brain changes at age 9, 10, 11. So this is beginning to build a picture that the psychopathic group have a neurodevelopmental disorder, not dissimilar to disorders like autism, with clear changes in their brains across time. Whereas antisocial men without psychopathy, we think, certainly in our study, there were no striking brain differences between that group and a matched normal group from the community.
So talk us through how you went about this. I believe you took scans of the brains through magnetic resonance imaging.
That's right.
Talk us through the process.
So the process is these were all men, our violent offenders group, all met criteria for antisocial personality disorder, and then we divided them into those who were more hot-headed, impulsive, and those who were more callous, lacking remorse, and so on. So a truly psychopathic group and a non-psychopathic group, another group of controls. All the violent offenders were recruited through probation services, so they'd all served prison sentences for crimes like murder, attempted murder, GBH, rape. They were now being looked after in the community very carefully by probation. We recruited them at that point, invited them to come to us, and they had a series of tests over about 3 days with us, including this particular test, a structural brain scan.
Given that your research is suggesting, at least in a third of men, that this is a condition,
yes,
rather than just bad attitude, if I can put it straightforwardly.
Yes.
What sort of an implication would this have then for the justice system? How people who have this condition are treated by the justice system?
Yes, well, at the moment, if you look at somebody who's been accused of murder, for example, in English courts, there is a defence available of diminished responsibility, which is typically available to those who have a clear mental disorder, such as a psychotic illness, like schizophrenia or bipolar affective disorder, where their behaviour was clearly abnormal as a result of that mental illness. And you're trying to convince a jury that the mental illness and the mental state the person had at that time was of sufficient severity to mean that they shouldn't be convicted of murder, but have available this defense of diminished responsibility, and then perhaps go on as a result of that defense to get a conviction of manslaughter. And then if you've committed that sort of thing while you've got schizophrenia or bipolar affective disorder, you may then go on to hospital treatment rather than treatment in prison. However, juries in English courts certainly remain resistant to a psychiatrist like myself standing up and saying, this person is truly psychopathic, and I know from my research that this is a neurodevelopmental disorder, because prosecution counsel would typically counter that by saying, well, look, half of men in British prisons have got antisocial personality disorder, a third of them have got psychopathy. Are you saying all these people should be out and in a hospital system? And of course, I'm not, but I think as this work develops over the next decade, you will have a much more convincing story to tell in courts. But
we are also talking about treating people, aren't we?
I mean,
it's not just a case of locking them away so we don't have to deal with them on a daily basis, isn't it? So
yes, I mean, I think you're trying to, what this research is trying to do is reduce heterogeneity and say you've got to be clear about which group you're treating. So antisocial men without psychopathy may respond reasonably well to programs that are already existent within the prison system, like reasoning and rehabilitation, where you're trying to get them to think through different approaches to dealing with frustrating situations rather than using violence. That works reasonably well, but that program doesn't work particularly well with the psychopathic group. But they tend to be all bundled together and encouraged to do the same treatment program, even if it has very little effect in the psychopathic offenders. So you're trying to say these are distinct groups with distinct brain bases, and that has to inform what sort of treatment programs you develop for them. We've got reasonable idea about how to treat the antisocial men without psychopathy, but we don't really have very good treatment ideas for the psychopathic group at the moment.
Dr. Nigel Blackwood of King's College London's Institute of Psychiatry there. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum, and you can follow us at dw_SciTech. Well, let's stay in the medical world for a moment, and in particular in the area of childbirth. There have been some quite fantastic developments in prenatal care, including 4D ultrasound machines lately. Having a baby has never been safer than it is now in Europe and other so-called rich parts of the world, and even things that may cause complications like obesity or the mother's age can be dealt with successfully, usually. In fact, as Nicole Goebel has been finding out, with all the latest treatments, equipment and trends, age, for one, is almost becoming irrelevant.
I'm surrounded by hundreds of specialists in prenatal care and obstetrics, as well as the latest machines and equipment for screenings and other tests. At 5 months pregnant, I'm particularly drawn to the 4D ultrasound machines. The babies look so real, but still slightly waxen and a tiny bit odd, I have to admit. But of course, I'm not just here at the 15th Congress of the German Association of Prenatal Medicine and Obstetrics to marvel at the lifelike ultrasound pictures. Germany's notorious for its low birth rate of just 1.36 children per woman. In Europe, only Hungarian women have fewer children. And it's pretty much been that low for the last 40 years. At the same time, screening methods and prevention have come a long way. Ultrasound images today, for example, are much clearer already in week 12 than they were in week 20 two decades ago. Professor Ulrich Gembruch is president of the Association of Prenatal Medicine and Obstetrics. He explains that many fetal defects can now be treated before giving birth.
Das kann medikamentös sein bei Herzrhythmusstörungen.
It could be with medication if there are heart rhythm abnormalities, blood transfusions when there is anemia. In extreme cases of diaphragmatic hernia, we can insert a balloon to encourage lung growth. We can also often operate spina bifida in the womb. Often we can do this in a minimally invasive way without open surgery.
Women also tend to have children later in life, statistically speaking, at 30 and a half years of age on average. In fact, 28% of women in Germany are over 35 when they conceive. And that includes me. In theory, it makes me more vulnerable to complications like preeclampsia or having a child with so-called autosomal trisomy. The most common type is known as Down syndrome. That's where modern ultrasounds come in. Professor Gembruch again.
20 years ago, you could measure heart activity in the baby's size, but that was it. Today, you can assess the heart, brain activity, you can measure the nasal bone and nuchal transparency, and you can spot the majority of Down syndrome cases with ultrasound. It means a mother's age has become largely irrelevant.
Which is reassuring. I opted for an amniocentesis to find out for certain if my baby had Downs. But Gembruch points out that it's by no means recommended to women anymore simply because of their age. As I wander around the stalls at the conference, I see all types of supplements for mums-to-be. I take a swig of a fortified juice being offered to me, and it's rather tasty. But it's only folic acid, Gembruch tells me, that is really absolutely essential to take, preferably starting several months before you want to conceive. It can prevent spina bifida, for example. I think it's fair to say that there are very few women who are not scared of giving birth. I certainly am. It's a painful process, for sure, but Karin Ballard, head midwife at Bonn's University Clinic, tells me why she's always happy to see a natural birth.
The woman gets strength in this way of delivery. After the delivery, the woman gets born as a mother. And for me, as a midwife, I'm the help. I help her to go the way.
I'm not entirely convinced, I have to say. I'm pretty sure I will want something for the pain. Ballard says that's not unusual and that older women often know exactly what they want. Plus, giving birth for the first time can be harder, so an epidural, which is also called a PDA, can be helpful.
For women who get the first baby and they don't know what's happened and what's coming, it's good to have the opportunity of the PDR.
Professor Gembruch agrees. The PDA, he says, is used in 60 to 70% of births. But it's not quite as common as in the UK, the US or Scandinavia. Often it's down to attitude, but sometimes there's no anaesthetist on shift, so an epidural is not an option. Which leads us to one of Gembruch's main objectives, bringing about structural changes in Germany to provide better pre- and perinatal care. Portugal, for example, vastly improved pre- and perinatal mortality rates by having deliveries almost exclusively in specialised clinics with different types of specialists in each one. And that's what Gembruch would like to see in Germany too.
Children with heart defects, for instance, can't be delivered in just any perinatal clinic. They have to be delivered where there are pediatric cardiac surgeons and cardiologists. And I think long-term in Germany, we should aim to offer every woman the opportunity to give birth in a hospital that has 24-hour pediatric care, as in other countries.
And specialized medical care also means mothers feel more at ease in the delivery room. If everyone works together, there's also a better atmosphere overall. And that's exactly what I'm hoping for when it's time for me to face that delivery room.
Nicole Goebel reporting there. And of course, we do wish her a very good birth indeed. In fact, come to think of it, she should be tweeting about her progress, I reckon. I think I might mention it.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Now, it's perhaps no surprise that Berlin's being touted as Europe's Silicon Valley, with some of the hottest sites and startups like SoundCloud, Amen and Spreadshirt all in the city, as well as so-called incubators like Team Europe. Well, some of the most prominent digital journalists, investors and technology companies have just had another chance to meet up at Next Berlin, Europe's leading digital technology conference in the capital. In addition to keynotes, workshops and panel discussions, there was also a track for startups to pitch to an international jury. Almost 100 applicants presented ideas from cloud computing, search engine optimization to tools for data organization, music apps, digital customer loyalty and a new sharing economy. Cinema Nippert was there.
The conference is literally abuzz with ideas and people getting their network on. In the startup track, 12 made it to the final round and got the opportunity to pitch their idea to a jury of international investors and decision makers. One of the most popular startups was Meine Spielzeugkiste, which means my toy box. Florian Spathelf is the CEO and founder.
Meine Spielzeugkiste is the first online toy rental for families who are moving to cities who have less room, but want to care about the development of their children. And with our service, they can rent recommended educational toys, and at the same time, they even save money.
Don't worry, the toys arrive shrink-wrapped, cleaned, and insured against breakage. In addition to being a practical service, Spathelf says Meine Spielzeugkiste is also motivated by a concern for the environment.
In our case, what drives us is that we can seriously reduce waste that's been caused by so many toys. Once you get used to the model that you don't have to possess the things, but you have the access to it, then I think there's room for more collaborative consumption models in Germany.
Charlie O'Donnell, partner at Brooklyn Bridge Ventures in New York, says collaborative consumption sounds good, but customers are always more concerned with money and convenience.
I go back to when I walked into the store and bought the fluorescent light bulb. It wasn't because, you know, the carbon footprint or the energy usage or whatever. It's because right there on the box it said lasts for 5 years. And I was like, great, I don't have to change the light bulb for 5 years. So if collaborative consumption makes you deliver a better product more cheaply, that's awesome. But the consumer, for the most part, doesn't care.
Yet O'Donnell says that Meine Spielzeugkiste does fit into a very particular niche.
I think the key to that business is making people feel like if you don't sign up for that, your kid is going to miss out. You know, that somebody else is picking the right toys, the tested toys, it's been curated. It's different than sort of an e-commerce model that is just replenishment or something like that.
One of the other startups pitching at Next was Kiero, a trivertising platform where consumers get to try products like chips, drinks and toothpaste for free and rate them. Thomas Metzler, founder and CEO of Kiero, has a background in psychology with a focus on advertising and marketing.
The problem is people don't really listen to conventional advertising because, for example, a toothpaste, a normal consumer changes his toothpaste every 10 years or something like that. And so if the companies advertise, oh, you get more shinier teeth or stuff like that, people, they don't buy it. But if we give them the product in their hands and say, okay, you try it. If you like it, you can buy it again. If not, then don't buy it again.
According to Charlie O'Donnell from Brooklyn Bridge Ventures, Kiero faces a couple of challenges.
Their challenge is nailing down and making sure that the people you put the product in the hands of are absolutely predispositioned to like what you have and want to talk about it.
O'Donnell says there's a tendency for people to look at successful startups and try to pull patterns out of them. While he's hesitant to predict overall trends, he does say that more and more people are interested in making a positive difference in the world. Etsy, for instance, has started a revival in handmade vintage items, and the fundraising platform Kickstarter also feeds into the custom-made market and provides some great stories about the products themselves.
I think one trend you're seeing in general is the story that goes with the product. This is why Kickstarter's taken off, right? Because I bought a set of speakers where the engineers email me every week saying, you know, we got a smaller battery in it, or the bigger speakers, or look at the new colors we added, or whatever. When I finally get this thing, 9 months later, I'm going to have a story to tell, right? I could have just bought it from Sony.
Interestingly, successful startups like New York's Etsy and Berlin's Devanda are not products of Silicon Valley. Mike Butcher, European editor of TechCrunch, says Berlin is moving beyond the hype into its own unique ecosystem.
Well, I think there's a continuing improvement in quality of startups coming out of Germany and particularly Berlin. But what we've seen in the last couple of years, a continuing interest in more innovative business models, coming up with new ideas, new implementations, new executions, new innovation, and it's taking it on a life of its own.
That new life has already given rise to a world leader in SoundCloud. And with new startups coming out of the German capital like Amen and Gidsy, Berlin is well on its way. Cinnamon Nippard, DW, Berlin.
Finally, to research of a more organic kind, and it's all about wood this time. We use wood for just about everything these days, from furniture and flooring to paper, toys and fuel. But as climate changes, the same goes for habitats for timber forests. Well, a European scheme called Reinforce is trying to discover which trees are going to provide it with a steady supply of timber. Robin Powell reports from one of the project's sites.
I'm standing in the rain at Westonbirt Arboretum in southwest England, just outside Bristol. It's Britain's national arboretum, and I'm surrounded by beautiful trees of all shapes and sizes, all species from around the world. But actually in front of me are two clearings with just a few very young trees in them. Rafe Johnson works at the Arboretum. He's with me, and he knows why. Rafe, what are we looking at here?
We're looking at trial plots for new forestry species to be grown in Europe. And here at Westonbirt, we've got three areas of about a hectare each, fenced off with deer fencing to protect the young trees. And in each plot, there's new species of trees that will hopefully replace existing forestry crops in Britain.
The project is called Reinforce, and the €4 million scheme is the most ambitious attempt yet to establish how certain trees will survive in a changing climate. It involves 37 sites in four countries, from the Isle of Mull in Scotland, down the Atlantic coast, through France and Spain, to the Azores in Portugal. Each site, including Westonbirt, will grow 30 different species.
They range from some trees that are most likely not going to do very well in the UK, but trees that will do very well in Portugal, southern Spain, trees such as the carob or the cork oak, up to trees that should do very, very well, such as coast redwoods, which we often see in gardens and collections, but as a forestry crop are pretty unknown. Oriental spruces is a particular tree that they're looking at.
So these have come from around the world, basically? These trees.
Yes, all around the world. North America, Asia, across Europe.
The trees will only reach maturity in several decades' time, so this study won't reap rewards immediately. During that period, researchers in each of the participating sites will monitor and share data on the tree size, their general health, and the timing of key events, such as when the buds appear. So why all this money and effort? Rupert Piggott is head of policy at Confor, which promotes forestry in the UK. He explains that past government policy led to the spread of monoculture in UK tree planting, and this has left our forests vulnerable not only to climate change, but to disease as well.
The way that we grow our trees here in the UK means that we do rely very heavily on certain species. The current issue we have is a disease called Phytophthora ramorum, which is affecting Japanese larch. And there are large swathes of larch down in the southeast and going up through Wales and on the west coast of Scotland, which are being affected by this.
But the UK doesn't need to rely on its domestic trees. It imports most of its timber. I asked John White from the Timber Trade Federation whether he thought the industry needed to examine new species to provide alternative sources of wood.
Well, there's no immediate need to do that. People will always be looking at sources of supply and the properties of the material that they use. And of course, for foresters, the planning process is over the longer term. Of course, it has to be. But it's so difficult to predict what's going to be happening over the next 100 years or so, especially with seemingly rapid change in climate.
Jane Carthouse from Confor says research projects like Reinforce need to keep in mind the timber industry's needs and its inertia.
To a certain extent, the markets will appear for what we are producing. I just have perhaps a slight concern. We need to do this in a joined up way, not go in total isolation.
The head curator at Westonbirt, Mark Ballard, says that the aims of the Reinforce project go beyond ensuring timber supplies for the future. The scheme is a reminder, he says, of our duty as stewards of nature.
One by one, these trees are being affected by different pests and disease. So we need to look at alternatives and we need to spread the risk. Just about being responsible managers.
This is Robin Powell for DW at Westonbirt Arboretum.
On that note, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep ahead of stuff at dw.de/sidetech or listen again, get the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfikar Abani. Studio Tech was Claudio Huck. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.